This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
This song speaks of the Festival Express, a train and series of concerts traveling across Canada in the summer of 1970 featuring the Grateful Dead, Janis Joplin, Delaney and Bonnie, and many more artists. Come see the film Festival Express Thursday, March 14th at the Clinton Street Theater at this month's KBOO Radio Pictures screening. All ticket sales benefit KBOO Radio and may be purchased now via our website, kboo.fm. Plus, we'll have another short film and a trivia contest for you to match wits with the hosts of KBOO's Grateful Dead and Friends program. That's Festival Express, Thursday the 14th at the Clinton Street Theater. Details and tickets available now at kboo.fm.
Good morning. This is Per Fogring, and the show is Political Perspectives. And my guest is Joel Magnuson, who is a professor of economics here in Portland. And he's written a book called Approaching Great Transformation Toward a Livable Post-Carbon Economy. Joel Magnuson, welcome to KBOO.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Well, let's jump right into it. You talk about, you start out with the twilight of the oil age, which is sort of only about 100 years old or so.
That's right.
So what was the oil age? You talk about internal combustion engines and...
It's essentially the 20th century, the oil age, mm-hmm. because that's when these technologies really started to develop, the internal combustion engine, as you mentioned, but also the process of cracking crude oil into fuels that can be burned in those engines. Mm-hmm. And it essentially revolutionized every major industry on the planet, you know, from agriculture to transportation and how we manufacture things, clothing, you know, et cetera. So this has been the primary fuel source for every industry over this century. And right now we're entering into that period in which that resource is starting to sort of evaporate.
Yeah, and maybe people don't appreciate how convenient oil and gasoline are. I mean, like, how can you fly an airplane on coal?
Exactly.
You know, a train will run on coal, but an airplane won't, you know?
That's right. And so we've been riding that wave for quite some time, and we've become very accustomed to this. And mm-hmm. so it's very hard for people to accept this idea that this is a resource that is now starting to dwindle in terms of availability, and there really isn't much that exists on the planet that can replace it, at least not to the scale with which we use fossil fuels, oil in particular.
Well, I was just on a little email exchange with a person back east, you know, and talking about, and he's saying, well, we got, you know, plentiful solar and energy and everything. Well, you know, to drive our cars on solar energy, we'd have to have a whole new system, you know.
That's right. And this the main problem with turning to renewables for our energy source is a problem of scale. Mm-hmm. Right now, all the renewable energy resources combined are less than 8% of our total energy consumption. Mm-hmm. And to somehow expand that to the scale with which we use oil and coal and natural gas would require so much investment, capital investment, new capital investment mm-hmm. in infrastructure, that it would be just literally cost prohibitive. And, you know, the resources to do that to the scale, again, is just impossible.
I think one way to kind of look at the cheap oil is that when the first oil well was drilled in Pennsylvania in 1859, they struck oil at 69 feet. You know, and then, of course, we've seen these movies, you know, with these Texas oil gushers and everything. Now, you know, what, you could drill 5 miles under the ocean and then horizontal drilling and fracking and all that.
Sure.
Oil is bound to be more expensive, and if the price of oil isn't at a certain level, they're not going to do all this stuff.
Well, virtually every serious oil geologist and energy physicist that I've talked to or read are basically drawing the same conclusion that that conventional oil production that you're talking about, the stuff that just kind of squirts out of the ground, peaked out, you know, some years ago, maybe as early as 2005. And this is precisely why the oil companies are going to these very capital-intensive, very complex and difficult ways of getting oil, like, you know, offshore drilling and so on. So, you know, that's an indication if they're going to do that, that the good stuff, the easy to get stuff, is really starting to disappear.
Well, you know, some people see this coming, not everybody, unfortunately, and people who see this coming are trying to prepare for it, and so we have the transition movement. So tell us about that.
Well, that's a movement that started in the UK. Again, it's, you know, very recent. Much of this stuff is very recent. I think the first transition community was formed in 2005. Mm-hmm. And their central project is what they call an energy descent action plan. Mm-hmm. And they're trying to prepare their communities, their local communities, for the inevitability that, you know, trucking things around the world in a global economy like we've been doing is just going to become increasingly difficult and increasingly expensive. And so they're trying to find ways that they can marshal their local resources to, you know, maintain their local economies.
Mm-hmm.
And that Rob Hopkins wrote a book on the transition handbook, and this is just, it went viral, at least in the English-speaking world, you know, here in the U.S., Canada, Australia. So it's, they're really setting, I think, the groundwork for, you know, other initiatives that can come in and follow up on this initiative. Yeah.
Well, though I know there are a lot of transition people right here in Portland,
that's
and if
right.
you want to give us a call, the number is 503-231-8187. How do you see the coming age of oil scarcity? Give us a call. So so this movement started in 2005, just a few years after that. You know, Portland, the city council commissioned this Peak Oil Task Force.
That's right.
I remember going to a lot of their meetings. It was kind of neat. There was, I think, 12 people were on this task force from different disciplines. Like, I know there's a retired farmer and there's an architect and there was different people connected with, you know, oil and transportation and all that kind of stuff. And they had these open meetings. They interviewed a lot of people who were sort of experts or know something about their particular field. And anybody could sit in on these meetings and raise questions. You know, not everybody could vote on the actual product, you know, the report that they made. And so it's a very comprehensive report. I think it was 2007. The city council voted, you know, they accepted this. So supposedly this report is a sort of official city policy.
Well, that was the first iteration of this process, and then later there was a more detailed report that came out, the Portland Plan, and that was last year, I think, is when that came out. And so that's, you know, they have, I think, some fairly ambitious goals in this plan, you know, about how they want city planning to evolve over the next decade or two, and making essential services available within walking distance in every community in the city of Portland, or actually the metro area. And that's actually something that I write about in this book, that, you know, the city of Portland is really in the lead in terms of planning, development, transportation infrastructure, housing, you know, all this sort of thing.
Yeah, I think that the goal was to, cut petroleum use in half by, I don't know, some not too distant date or something like that.
Yeah, that's why I say it's a bit ambitious. Mm-hmm. But, I think that it's nonetheless realistic when we look at the possible economic turbulence that could start when oil starts to push back mm-hmm. up over $150 a barrel.
Well, you could argue that it's an ambitious goal, but it's going to be forced up. It's not one we're going to choose. It's going to be forced on us.
One way or another. Yeah. That's right.
Well, I don't know if you cover it in your book, but this Columbia River crossing seems to me to fly in the face of all this detailed knowledge about, cheap oil and everything. What do you think about the Columbia River crisis? It's a big deal right now. Everybody's talking about it.
Yeah, everybody's talking about it. I haven't really followed the story that much. Mm-hmm. I mean, it just seems like there's so many different stakeholders in this deal. People who are going to make a lot of money on this, and that seems to be the driving force behind mm-hmm. this more than anything else.
But I think the cost of it is going to be $3.5 billion.
Something like that. So I don't know how much of that's mm-hmm. going to come from the federal government. I think that's still up in the air. Mm-hmm. But
well, they're counting on some money. It's a good question of whether they'll get it.
Right.
And if they don't, will that derail the whole thing or not? I don't know.
Yeah, there's there's a number of triggers out there that mm-hmm. Are still potentially going to shoot this thing down. The Coast Guard might not approve this mm-hmm. for, whatever reason.
Mm-hmm. Well, the thing that really struck me was I've been told by people who know that the sort of the background for this project, it was based on a projection of oil at $100 a barrel.
Right.
And which is just obviously ridiculous, but they're stuck with it. And I think we got a couple phone calls. So Joanne is on the line. Morning, Joanne.
Hello. I don't know much about Iceland, and I was wondering if they use oil in their country. And also, I heard something, but I may not be right about they using thermal energy.
They do, yes.
Okay, I'll get off the phone. Bye.
Iceland has got volcanoes and hot springs and everything. In fact, the city of Reykjavik, which is, I think, about 60,000 people, I think they heat the entire city with hot water from underground. I believe they even have indoor pineapple plantations.
And bananas.
Bananas.
Yeah.
They're very proud of their bananas in Iceland. But anyway, what else? She was talking about Iceland, and also she raised another issue about...
Well, Iceland, mm-hmm. It was... I can't remember what publication, but Iceland, Reykjavik, was considered to be the greenest mm-hmm. major
yeah,
city
that.
in the world, but number two on that list was Portland,
mm-hmm.
and part of it is our energy sources that we have. I mean, we just happen to have an abundance of hydroelectric power mm-hmm. here in Portland that helps in that regard.
Oh yeah, well, we do have thermal stuff too going on around the Arid Bend and high desert.
That's right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I think we got another phone call. Jeff is on the line. Morning, Jeff.
Hi, yeah. Well, first of all, let me just say that supposedly cheap hydroelectric power we have is getting real, real expensive, And as far as Portland leading in housing and other things like that, maybe where you live, that's visible, but not where I live. Where I live, I see management companies who do the bare minimum to keep their horrific landlords out of court. I got evicted from an apartment last year after I moved out and left it clean and empty while my dad was fighting cancer. Mm-hmm. This town doesn't lead in anything that I can see except laziness. If you can get a city inspector to show up at a property, that's a miracle, because basically the law is written to say that unless the landlord agrees to the inspection, he can't even show up. And if the landlord agrees to show up and then doesn't show up, the property can't be inspected anyway. There are some major holes in that theory, my friend. Thank you.
Okay.
The previous guest here was talking about some of these issues.
Mm-hmm. Well, I don't know about inspectors. I used to have a duplex on Belmont, and sometimes inspectors would just show up. There was one woman who was sort of the nuisance inspector for that area who I think people thought she was a nuisance. She was a former nun, I think. Anyway, very interesting lady. But she would, if they get a complaint, they can just kind of come into your backyard and browse around. And while they're looking for the signs of the first complaint, they can look around and see if they see anything else. But that doesn't have too much to do with cheap oil.
Not really, yeah.
So we're back to the transition movement. Mm-hmm. So the transition movement is started in England and is spreading quite a lot.
That's right. And, you know, there's a lot of interesting projects that are going on within the transition movement. Mm-hmm. Though what I write about here in the book is that what the transition movement really needs to do is to take the next step in working on creating new and completely different economic institutions in their local communities.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the problem, one of the central problems with the transition movement, is that they identify these goals, yet their expectation is that they can achieve those goals within the institutional structure that actually has created these problems in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
And so that, I think, is, you know, one of the central messages of the book overall, is that we really need to start rethinking, you know, what kind of institutions, economic institutions particularly, we need to have in order to sort of make it through this transition.
Well, they need to get specific, I think.
Specific.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, we got another caller on the line. Martha's on the line. Morning, Martha.
Good morning. One of the issues that seems to get minimal play is that the single biggest consumer of fossil fuels is the Department of Defense or the Department of War.
Mm-hmm.
And when fossil fuels become even more scarce, that's going to be problematic. Some major superpowers are not going to be doing that anymore.
That's interesting. You know, it's the Pentagon, one of the biggest oil consumers in the world.
And biggest polluters also.
That's true, yeah. They go hand in hand, hand in glove or whatever. But it's... You know, some people say there'll be all kinds of wars for oil as it gets more and more scarce. But then other people say that, well, the war itself will use up more oil than it gets back. It's that energy return issue.
That's right,
And the position of the U.S. is the superpower. It runs on fossil fuel.
That's right.
Going to be a major game changer.
How can we fight wars without a lot of, without airplanes and aircraft carriers and all that kind of stuff, all these Humvees and, you know, all this stuff? How can we fight any kind of war?
Or just the munitions industry that mm-hmm. uses these fossil fuels, you know.
And that ties in also to climate crisis.
Mm-hmm. Well, what about, that's another thing you mentioned in the book, is that along with this, sort of peak oil, we also got peak water and we got peak climate chaos.
You know, or what Richard Heinberg calls peak everything,
mm-hmm.
because it's not just oil, it's every resource, you know, topsoil, fresh water.
Mm-hmm. Phosphates.
Phosphates for mm-hmm. growing food. Just, you know, the basic metals and rare earth metals, actually, too, mm-hmm. they're very, very scarce and becoming increasingly scarce. So these are constraints on economic growth. And unfortunately, most economists don't really want to address that problem, you know, because the standard orthodox approach to economics is that economies can grow forever and ever, and limits to growth mm-hmm. just don't exist in their world.
This is amazing. I've had people tell me this, you know, over email, that enough investment will will produce oil somehow. And it seems to me common sense. If the oil isn't there in the ground, you can throw all kinds of money at it, and you're not going to get oil where there is none.
Well, there's actually two ways that you can look at this. One is just this basic energy rate of return on energy invested. Mm-hmm. You know, how much energy does it take to get the energy out of the ground? Mm-hmm. And, you know, that number is getting smaller and smaller as we have to dig deeper and deeper to get that oil.
Mm-hmm.
But then the other aspect of this is that a lot of these major oil companies that are doing this don't care if that energy rate of return is negative, as long as they're getting subsidies from the government to do the drilling and you know, make these capital investments.
So it is profitable for them because they're getting subsidized.
That's right.
Mm-hmm. Well, one amazing thing is that I just heard this recently. I should have known it a long time ago, I guess. It's not a big secret. Is that, you know, the Hoover Dam by Las Vegas, you know, Lake Mead, and it's an amazing structure. My wife and I, we took a bus trip and went across it at night. It's just quite a big thing, you know. And Lake Mead has been slowly getting lower and lower and lower. And if it gets down to 1,050 feet, which they're close to already, that all the turbines at the Hoover Dam will shut off.
Hmm.
That means Las Vegas and probably L.A. do not get, if they don't get cut off completely from their power source, they're going to have reduced power.
Or they'll have to, you know, somehow come up with some other way to generate electricity there.
Mm-hmm.
And to run those slot machines.
I wonder what they're doing right now. I hear in Las Vegas they got a very energetic woman who's sort of the water person there, who's been, planning pipelines from all over the place, you know, to give Las Vegas water and different things. But I think she's not ready to say that, well, growth may have to stop or that the city's in real trouble.
Well, this question of energy infrastructure, you know, like mm-hmm. building more hydroelectric dams or, mm-hmm. or wind turbines or solar arrays or algae ponds or whatever, you know, source people are looking at. But again, I go back to this issue of scale.
Mm-hmm.
And I think part of what's not being addressed specifically in the discourse is that this is really an issue of capital formation. You know, dams, solar arrays, wind farms, they all require an enormous amount of real, tangible, physical capital.
Mm-hmm.
And to build up that infrastructure to the scale with which we use oil and coal would require that we dramatically ramp up our economic growth so that we can form the capital to make those investments. Mm-hmm. And that's precisely what we can't do.
Wow.
And that the Energy Outlook report that just came out in last fall said that globally, to sustain our current level of energy consumption, which includes the traditional fossil fuels,
mm-hmm.
we would have to make $37 trillion of additional capital investments, and about $10 trillion of that would have to come from here in the United States.
So you need that. There's no way to substitute, like, just sort of a command economy. We just, you know, years ago the Chinese used to get 1 million people out there doing different tasks, you know.
Right. Well, you know, in this case, this is more about infrastructure mm-hmm. development. And mm-hmm. so, you know, to aggregate that kind of capital would be, you know, would have to come from a fossil fuel-based system. Compound that with, you know, the fact that the conventional fuels are disappearing, plus mm-hmm. Compound it again to accommodate ongoing economic growth.
Wow. Well, we got some more people on the line. Jack is on the line. Morning.
Yeah, I'm going to be the contrarian today.
Okay, good. We need a contrarian.
Yeah, and I know you've looked into this. I've shared some information with you before, Pear, about abiotic oil, and
mm-hmm.
you've looked into it a bit, I think. And there is evidence a lot of the wells they thought were dry are refilling. Mm-hmm. And where's this oil coming from? The research shows that it's coming from deep, deep within the earth. One of the reasons that deep drilling is what's going on now, because the notion of fossil fuels is has been challenged by the Russians. It went back to the 50s, even before that, they were challenging this notion. Concept being that oil is not, oh, perhaps partially a fossil fuel, but there's a lot of oil coming from deep within the Earth's mantle, and it's being created there by pressure and chemical minerals present and under extreme pressure. And in fact, the oil, the whole suite of oil, of petroleum compounds has been created in the laboratory under those kinds of conditions, taking raw minerals and putting them under extreme pressure.
Mm-hmm.
And this has actually been duplicated in the laboratory. So that's questionable whether or not petroleum is really a limited resource. Now, there is the question, of course, how affordable is it to get? You know,
mm-hmm.
And that certainly is a question. But I think that to proceed with the polemic anyway, it's wiser to at least acknowledge what you really got, rather than continue to tout the notion of fossil fuels that are finite.
Well, has any of this abiotic oil gotten on the market? Not that I know of, but I don't know everything.
Well, I think the Russians have become a leading oil producer,
mm-hmm.
and I'm certain that a lot of their oil is.
The Russians have always been leading oil producers in that conventional sense, anyway. And with these, I hear these things a lot, that we can manufacture the energy that we need, or we could go toward nuclear fusion, or thorium, or there's just I'm always barraged with the litany of that there's some technological fix to this problem, and the questions that I ask are, how much is it going to cost to develop this technology and the infrastructure? And then how much would it cost to scale that up to the level that we use this conventional oil and coal and natural gas that's right now it's very easy to get? And that's...
Well, those are good questions. And to be clear, when I brought up the point that petroleum has been created in the laboratory, that was to demonstrate how the model of its creation within the Earth's mantle, not as an effort to show, we can manufacture oil. No, you're absolutely right. The cost of doing it would be exorbitant, thousands of times greater than what you get. And with renewables now, the wind and solar, we see that we're just now maybe on the edge of getting to the point where it's affordable, in that it returns more than it costs to set up the process.
Well, then the question I have is, right now we have a $15 trillion GDP economy. The Social Security Administration projects over the next decade or two that we're going to sustain about a 2.5% growth rate, which means that our economy is expected to double every 30 or 40 years, to a $30 trillion economy, and then to a $60 trillion. And at some point we have to recognize that ongoing economic growth on a finite planet is just, it's just a contradiction. And I don't think it's helpful, really, for us to entertain, technological fantasies that, this is the laws of nature and chemistry and physics can be conquered with technological fixes. I think that's you know, it's opium dreams.
Well, I think we got some other callers on the line. Brian is on the line.
Hey.
Morning, Brian.
Hey, how are you doing? this is such a huge subject, it's hard for, and I'm an economic nincompoop, but, you know, Scotland is pretty much leading the world in wind technology right now, and a good part of the country is now. Am I still on the line?
Sure, yes.
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. Gosh, it was awful quiet, isn't it? Yeah,
we're sitting here in awe, Brian.
Yeah. give me a break. okay, Scotland is pretty much leading the world, mm-hmm. Europe, and in wind, and Germany is leading the world for sure in solar.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the cycle in Scotland is interesting because, you know, Scotland and most of England used to be covered in trees. And they were all cut down for the Industrial Revolution. And then, you know, so it was left with a lot of bogland there that even the sheep have a hard time thriving on. And suddenly all these boglands are sprouting these wind farms, and the sheep seem to have a pretty easy time with it. You know, there's some pros and cons of it, but there's several large cities now powered entirely by wind, and there's also some of the communities that were affected that made some money out of the oil boom, especially up in the north of the Orkneys, have reinvested that money in community wind farms. So there's a sort of interesting cycle there of renewal as the technology becomes available. And one of the things I like about wind and solar is that it doesn't dump anything back on the earth that isn't natural, that it doesn't dump anything at all. You know, you're obviously going to have turbines running out and solar panels running out eventually, but, you know, the trouble with the fuels we've created in the laboratory are the extraction cycle in the Western mind, especially the invaders of this country, is, you know, exploit, dig, extract, use, but don't put anything back. And you know, that's the trouble with it. That's never been thought through entirely as a process, or as the Indians would say, a part of the great circle of life. So the square is dumping everything back in the middle. And, I mean, you know, since Hugo Chavez died, I mean, everybody's, you know, the greenmongers are speculating, God, Venezuela's sitting on a big lake of oil more than Saudi Arabia even. But
it's pretty crappy oil, though.
Yeah, but still, you know, it's there and easy to get at. But what I'm saying is the cycle of production, extraction and production has never been thought through to it. I mean, look at the dolls, the dams. You know, I mean, they're piling up radioactive silt at the base of these dams from the Columbia, and I don't hear anybody talking about that, too.
No, I didn't know about that.
Even if you managed to take the dams down, what mm-hmm. would happen to that silt?
Hmm.
Anyway, I'm maybe gobbling on a bit, but I'm quite proud of Scotland for being mm-hmm. on the leading edge of that technology, and thinking it through as something that they reinvested from the oil boom, which the Thatcher government got most of. But, you know, some communities looked beyond that and actually turned it into something that's renewable. So, you know, I think there should be more thinking like that, and I'll let the rest of it go.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's a transition movement is supposed to be doing.
That's right, and mm-hmm. and that's a very, very good point that that he's making here. That we still have time, we have resources that we can use to make those kinds of investments mm-hmm. in alternative energy. One of the concerns I have about this is that when you look at a relatively small percentage of the population that have these success stories, it doesn't necessarily apply to the rest of the world. You know, that affluent areas like Portland or Edinburgh or Berlin, I mean, we can generate the kind of capital that we need to invest in these alternative energy sources. But when we start talking about, say, small farming communities in Africa or Asia, you know, a small increase in the price of basic fuels will devastate those communities.
Well, I've read about, villages in Africa, you know, people living in, you know, these small houses, huts and things, and they have a little solar thing on the roof.
Yeah.
And it's enough to give them, a light bulb or two or, power their cell phone or the radio and different things like that. In other words, they do get enough to improve their way of living.
In a very, very small way. But, you know, if they're still dependent on transportation fuels to get their product market,
right?
Then a small increase in price of that fuel actually really does serious damage to those communities.
Well, this is Political Perspectives, and my guest is Joel Magnuson, who's an economist here in Portland, who's written a book, The Approaching Great Transformation. And we have another caller on the line. Thomas, welcome to KBOO.
Yes, good morning, Pierre. Good morning, Mr. Magnuson.
Good morning.
Yeah, important program, and love the discussion. Just a few thoughts about this, in relation to the energy issues. You know, it occurs to me that something like 7,000 times of the daily, entire Earth's daily energy demand falls on the Earth every day in the form of sunshine. So, in other words, we would have to harness 1/7,000th of the sun every day with no increases in energy efficiency to meet the global energy needs. So I think that's worth reflecting on, no pun intended. And it's also worth reflecting on that Germany has a very ambitious alternative energy program, and instead of constantly pushing back the date to which they're going to achieve higher levels of alternative energy, they keep bringing it forward. What I understand now is that the massive investment of solar in, of all places in Germany, where there is so much less sunlight than, let's say, many areas of the United States, I believe they're projecting that something like within the next 10 or 15 years, something like 70% of their energy resources being alternative. So, this is real. And a couple other thoughts on the abiotic oil thing. Whether that's real or not, let's just for the sake of argument assume that abiotic oil or something like that's real. Immediately, I see two problems. Number one, clearly oil wells are dropping all over the country, so even if that process happens, the replenishment rate may not be much. What are you going to do, wait around for 50 years for oil to replenish? And even if there is a replenishment of oil resources at some point, we're right back to the same problems of global warming and pollution and control and war over it. So that's kind of a non-starter. And my last comment is about your guess. I agree with essentially everything Mr. Magnuson said, but I have to agree very hard with the idea of giving a false concreteness to the idea of, quote, real hard capital, unquote. I would say there is really no such thing as capital. That's essentially, ultimately, a convenient accounting fiction. And that's as real as we want to make it. I know it's easy to make it more real this time with this talk of these phony deficits and so forth, but there have been times in human history like World War II where there have been a complete wholesale changing of the economy. Really, we're just talking about balance books here. The only real capital that exists are the raw materials, the human knowledge and technology to garner that, and a plan to make it work. So we can go beyond any of these accounting fictions. I think that the only real, impediment that I see ultimately right now, given our technological capabilities, is the inertia of vested big financial interests in the status quo and their ability to buy legislation and governance. And I think that is the ultimate block from my perspective.
Oh, you raised a good point. What do you think?
Well, when we talk about capital formation, this is exactly what I was talking about. I'm not talking about just money in the bank. I'm talking about actual physical capital and infrastructure. And again, Berlin, in Germany, they have done an enormous amount of work in terms of moving toward solar energy, but that still constitutes a relatively small percentage of their overall energy consumption profile. And to expand that to the scale with which we use fossil fuels I keep repeating this, but it seems like we need to make that point clear. To expand that to the scale to which we use oil and coal would require an enormous amount of the very physical capital that the caller was talking about. So it's not just a matter of having money in the bank. It's having the transmission lines and the frames that hold the solar panels, the panels themselves, restructuring our urban centers so that they're closer to the energy sources, restructuring our transportation systems, and so on. If we try to envision that as our future, and I've heard others say that, by 2050, alternative energy sources now will be approaching, 30 or 40 or 50% of our overall energy consumption. But I think what they're not saying in those statistics is that overall energy consumption level will be much lower than it is now. So to say that it's going to be 50%, that may be true, but that's 50% of an overall energy consumption profile that'll be much, much smaller than it is today. I disagree that the principal bottleneck here is just inertia. Politically, I think that's a problem, but I think the real bottleneck is that we just don't have the resources, physical resources, to build up that kind of infrastructure. It would be like, let's say, the only thing that's really stopping us from building a floating bridge between Portland and Hawaii is politics. It's just, that's not really the situation here. It's just physically not possible.
One thing that kind of comes to mind, getting to an electric economy, it still doesn't fly planes, but maybe that's a good idea, a good thing if you don't like flying. But what about, you mentioned that all these data centers, there's 3 million data centers around the world. That really kind of struck me, and they use 30 billion watts of energy.
That's right. Yeah.
Is there any what's the future of the internet then?
This is another concern that we are increasingly becoming dependent on processing information in the cloud, sending streaming videos and PDF files and, Google and Facebook and all these things. They run these data centers around the world.
Three of them in Prineville, I think.
Yeah, that's right.
That's amazing.
These new ones.
Yeah.
And they're basically these big warehouses that are just packed with these giant, very powerful servers, and they get hot. And they have to have these industrial cooling systems to cool them down. And they also have to have auxiliary energy source systems in case there's a power failure. Because even one fraction of a second of a power failure can crash these servers. And, if a server at a data center crashes, then, all of the work that we do online then starts to get disrupted, and there's pandemonium, and God forbid if we lose, files and that sort of thing.
Wow, that seems to me a very dubious future. I say keep your books, folks. Don't throw away those books yet. You may want them.
The New York Times ran a piece where they did a year-long research project on this, and they found that paper print is actually energy more efficient than the Kindle version.
Really? Oh, wow. Yeah. Let me take the time to tell people what is coming up on KBOO. At 10, Chris Andre hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. 10:15 is Flashpoints, Investigative News Radio with host Dennis Bernstein. At 11, we have the Dirt Bag with Glenn Andreessen welcomes back Home Orchard Society President Joni Cooper to talk about their fruit propagation fair at the Clackamas County Fairgrounds in Canby. Oh, I didn't know about that. That's a nice fairgrounds down there. And I want to thank KABU members for your generous support of your community radio station. If you're not a KABU member, you can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. Do we have anybody else waiting to talk? George is on the line. Morning, George.
Hey, good morning. Hi, Pear. I was reading a couple of books about a year ago. One of them was published by Cambridge University Press, and the title of the book is simply Wind Power. And I had been hearing arguments that it's way too expensive and it's problematic to build wind farms. And the author goes over some of the arguments and says, well, actually, the amount of material and money and energy needed to build these is a lot less than to build, for example, nuclear power plants. And, of course, he says it varies a good deal depending on the wind patterns you have. If you have a long coastline with a lot of onshore wind or a landmass with a lot of offshore wind, you can get a lot of wind power, kilowatts or megawatts out of that. And I can't remember the author's name, but that book gives a much more optimistic view, I think, than one hears often. And then I was looking at a book by a guy named Benjamin Sovacool, which is called Contesting the Future of Nuclear Power, and it was published in 2011 by the World Scientific Press. And there's a short paragraph on page 287 where Sovacool is looking at the Fukushima Daiichi accident and how expensive it was and will be for Japan. And he says that it's too bad that Japan didn't choose to invest instead of putting in their nuclear power plants. He said with the amount of onshore and offshore wind they have, they could have built enough wind power farms without getting in the way of the essential harbor facilities and so on to supply all of the electricity and then more that the total number of nuclear plants they have in Japan was producing. And I just couldn't believe this, but he says, check it out. He's got the Sovacool has done a few papers on these matters over the last 20 years. So I don't know. I'm not any kind of a knowledgeable reader in this, but it seems to me it's important to read the views that, you know, say they offer a different critical point of view from the other side about some of these alternative energy resources.
Mm-hmm.
So that's all I have. I just thought I'll get off and listen to the comments on the radio.
Thanks for the information, George. Good to hear from you, too. Mm-hmm. Okay, I think we got another call. We have more callers on the line. Let's try Diet. Okay, good morning.
Good morning. I have a comment about what your speaker is saying about, you know, needing all this huge infrastructure and so forth and all these transmission lines. I would encourage him to think small, or encourage all of us to think small. I was in Germany, maybe 15 years ago when they were putting in a lot of solar panels. And what they did was just give people a tax incentive to put their own solar panels on their roofs and, make their homes more energy self-sufficient. And also, I have a friend in Africa who has a solar panel on his roof of a very humble house, but it's enough to power his computer and lights occasionally, and he's happy. He doesn't need, your guest was talking about needing, the cost of energy going up and so how the cost of a product going up. I mean, we're just talking about people meeting their daily needs. And if we can take care of those kinds of things, then we're a long ways ahead toward becoming energy self-sufficient just as a nation. So rather than thinking huge, let's think small.
Well, that's actually the central point of my book, The Approaching Great Transformation, is that that's in a way kind of an inevitability that going, relocalizing and envisioning things at smaller scale is what we have to do, and probably because we're not going to have a choice in the matter.
Hmm. Well, if enough... Do we have any more callers on the line? LJ is on the line. Morning, LJ. Yep. LJ, are you there?
Hello?
Good morning, LJ. We hear you.
Good morning, Pear. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
All right. Thank you so much for the show. Can we talk about the impact of climate change and our continually burning of carbonized fossil fuels?
Okay.
You know, we're at that tipping point now, Pear, where we can definitely change the impact of the whole Earth environmental structure if the planet heats up any more than it has right now.
Okay, let's talk about that.
Okay, and can we also talk about the impact of the Alberta tar sands?
Okay.
And how that's going to impact the planet. And can I just recommend the book?
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Okay. What every environmentalist needs to know about capitalism. And it's by Fred Magnoff and John Bellamy Foster.
Oh, okay.
Okay, and I certainly will take my answers off the air. And thank you so much for the show, Pat.
No, thank you. Okay. Tar sands and climate change.
So that's, you know, the transition movement that we were talking about earlier, their initiatives are not just to deal with the problem of peak oil and post-peak oil issues, but also climate change as well. And those two obviously are very closely connected. And so when we talk about economic growth, which again is the core model, all of our economic institutions and government institutions are built on an assumption that that's how our economies are going to function. They're just going to continue to grow. In fact, our financial institutions and even our expectations as individual consumers and investors, we all are sort of part of that growth machine. And so on the one hand, you know, we have this system that just always has to keep growing. And what he said, what every environmentalist needs to know about capitalism, you know, that's the machine. It's a capitalist machine, and it's programmed for ongoing growth.
What happens if the economy stopped growing? What happens then? I mean,
then we have a crisis.
And how would it actually hit us? We'd have a crisis.
Well,
debts don't get paid.
Well, when we've been going through this, you know, we can see what happens. You know, debts don't get paid, then banks start to go insolvent.
Mm-hmm.
Then the machinery of capital investment and, you know, the bond markets and credit markets and all that start to grind to a halt. And everything just starts to unravel. People get thrown out of work, and that's what I mean when
I say the money system. Does the money system collapse?
The money system starts to collapse, and so the reason why we're so vulnerable in this way is because this is the way our economic institutions have been constructed and have evolved over the last, you know, arguably 500 years. You know,
I think so. I think you could say that. Yeah.
Right. And so when, you know, when I say the problem, the core problem is institutional, well, this is exactly what I'm talking about. And climate change is one of the constraints that are tightening like a rope around this growth-driven system that, you know, last year was the hottest year on record.
Wow, that's right.
And, yeah, so.
Well, we got a few minutes left. Let's take another phone call. David's on the line. Good morning, David.
Hi, good morning. I'm wondering if your guest, if you would please articulate just a vision, for example, in a place like Portland, of what it might look like over the next few years for us to make a sustainable transition, what that might look like on a level of a city this big.
Okay. I think that's probably our last phone call that we have time for.
Yeah.
So let's talk about what Portland could look like.
Yeah, that's good for a wrap up.
Mm-hmm.
Actually Portland's already starting to look like what it should look like. You know, that it's making a lot of efforts to contain growth. And, you know, the city planners, for better or for worse, are ramping up for more density and, you know, seeing how we can reduce the number of miles that everything has to move around in order to meet people's needs and communities. So what I write about in this book is really approaching this problem from a spirit of celebration, like, you know, not that we're being punished and that we're, you know, forced to have to go and you know, just throw ourselves into poverty because we're running out of energy, but rather that we can start fashioning new business models, you know, largely as a function of need, but also as I said, in the spirit of celebration and creativity, where we can really enjoy coming together in communities and have, you know, regular, you know, trade fairs and places where people can really start to develop their own skills and their own ability to produce the things that right now have been sort of sent around the world in the global division of labor.
Well, I know that's in your last chapter. We never were able to get to that, but it's a very interesting chapter on what the future could look like if we make it happen. So I want to thank Joel Magnuson, our guest today, who is the author of The Approaching Great Transformation. Very interesting book, worth reading. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Per.
And stay tuned to KBOO for good radio.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM, 91.9 FM Hood River and the Gorge, 100.7 FM Corvallis and Albany. The time is 9:59. Coming up at 10 o'clock is Chris Andre, as she hosts Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary. At 10:15, hear Flashpoints, investigative news radio with your host, Dennis Bernstein. And at 11 on The Dirtbag, host Glenn Andreessen welcomes back Home Orchard Society President Joni Cooper to talk about the March 17th Fruit Propagation Fair at the Clackamas County Fairgrounds in Cambie.
KBOO Community Radio Night for the 2013 Blazers season will be April 17th, the last home game of the regular season.
Tickets are limited for this unique opportunity where a portion of the proceeds will help support your community radio station.
More information can be found at kboo.fm/blazers.
Hugo Chavez, president of Venezuela, died last week, and hundreds of thousands of people poured into the streets to mourn him. Arguably the most influential leader in Latin America for over a decade, what will his legacy be? Join me, Linda Olson Osterlund, for a deeper look this Thursday morning at 9:30 a.m. My guest is Miguel Tinker Salas, professor of Latin American Studies at Pomona College and author of The Enduring Legacy, Oil, Culture, and Citizenship in Venezuela. That's this Thursday morning at 9:30 a.m.
This song speaks of the Festival Express, a train and series of concerts traveling across Canada in the summer of 1970 featuring the Grateful Dead, Janis Joplin, Delaney and Bonnie, and many more artists. Come see the film Festival Express Thursday, March 14th at the Clinton Street Theater at this month's KBOO Radio Pictures screening. All ticket sales benefit KBOO Radio and may be purchased now via our website, kboo.fm. Plus, We'll have another short film and a trivia contest for you to match wits with the hosts of KBOO's Grateful Dead and Friends program. That's Festival Express, Thursday the 14th at the Clinton Street Theater. Details and tickets available now at kboo.fm.
Good morning, Cascadia. Today is Wednesday, March 13th, 2013, and you're listening to KBOO Portland, your community radio at 90.7 FM, kbol.fm on the web. Here in Cascadia, under a dubious leadership, Kitsubba strides into the biggest boondoggle since the freeway to nowhere. The Columbia River crossing bill is signed, but far from sealed or delivered. And a movement to end the silence on Palestine is growing every year. It's a silence that is killing Palestinians, though, every day. Coming this weekend, the remembrance of the 10th anniversary of the murder of Rachel Corrie at the hands of the Israeli Defense Forces. And in Tunisia, we mentioned this yesterday, this is important to note, a young man set fire to himself out of rage, frustration, and despair just hours before voting began on the new government in that nation. It might behoove the government of the United States of America to perhaps learn a bit about culture and society before it backs some of these revolutions. And we're going to try to speak with Robert Naiman on AIPAC's push for war. The drumbeat continues, and it's getting nastier by the day, somewhat below the radar, but nonetheless, it's there. And we first know this from the National Weather Service. Overcast skies today with a high near 63 and overnight lows around 50. Tomorrow starts out cloudy but dry, developing a certain je ne sais